Ladies and gentlemen, as the culmination of the fall series of Vancouver Institute lectures, I'm very pleased to introduce Professor Rosenblum. He is Professor of Fine Arts at New York University in the Fine Arts Institute there. He is a specialist in art of the modern period, received his PhD from NYU, and did his thesis on neoclassicism. He's the author of a standard book on Cubism and 20th century art, and he was Slade Professor at Oxford in 1972. This evening, he will speak to us on the subject Picasso and, if I get the pronunciation correct, the Guernica of 1937. Professor Rosenblum.
Thank you.
Now, let's see. It's like a jet plane here. So many things to do. I think that's going to... Oh, that looks right. Well, this is the last of four lectures on paintings and moments in Picasso's career. For some of you, I realize it will be the first rather than the last lecture, but I hope that it will be intelligible in itself. Just, however, by way of background, if I can find, yes, slide, forward. Reverse. No. We'll be all right. There we go. Well, I think it's going to be all right. If it isn't, and amen. That's the one I wanted. Maybe I'm just not... I think it means that. Do not remember. Maybe I'm touching it wrong. Well, anyway, just as a... not a preview, but a post-view, in the first and the third lectures, I spoke at some length about these two pivotal works by Picasso, the Demoiselle d'Avignon of 1907 and the Girl Before a Mirror of 1932. And what I tried to do, especially because this is not the first half of the 20th century, for better or for worse, it's the second half, is to think about Picasso not so much as a young Turk, as a rebel, who painted pictures the likes of which you had never seen before, but rather as an artist who really had the enormous weight of history upon his shoulders, and who in paintings like these, so I tried to demonstrate, instead of painting something that had never been seen before, well, that was partly true, he also painted works that tended to synthesize, to embody in multiple dimensions, all kinds of archetypes, all kinds of moments in the history of art that preceded these works. So they have really a kind of backward-looking, a kind of retrospective character, as well as a forward-looking one. This evening, I'm going to deal with that painting, and let's hope it stays. That painting, about which we've already had a slight word, namely how the title is pronounced. It is, I should hasten to say, called Guernica in Spanish. That's the Spanish pronunciation. But in the English-speaking world, for better or for worse, it seems to have been altered to Guernica or Guernica. So you have your choice among those pronunciations, whether you want to be Iberian or Anglo-Saxon. This evening I'm going to talk about this painting, which of all paintings by Picasso is the most fully synthetic, the most fully retrospective in terms of all kinds of archetypes in the history not only of art, but in the history of Western civilization. But before I do so, and we are looking at it in one of its penultimate states, it was happily photographed during the evolution of the work in the spring of 1937. Before I do so, I would like quickly to remind you, especially those of you who are happily younger than the Guernica, which is just this year, 40 years old, I'd like to remind you of some of the historical circumstances that engendered this work. Picasso, in the spring of 1937, had been commissioned, like some other artists, both Spanish and non-Spanish, to decorate, if that is the proper word for the result, a portion of the Spanish pavilion at the... Hello. That's the nicest thing that's ever happened to me in a lecture. Is that right? He had been commissioned to paint something for the Spanish pavilion at the World's Fair of 1937 in Paris, where he, like any other, any number of other artists, and especially Spaniards, was living. And he hesitated. He seemed to put off the commission, though he was quite capable of doing things rapidly, until an event of international moment occurred on the 26th of April of that year, 1937. On a market day in the little Basque city, in fact the capital of the Basque country, Guernica, German planes flying for Franco during the early days of the Spanish Civil War bombed this defenseless city, and there was, for the time at least, though certainly not by latest statistics, a hideous number of civilians killed, men, women, and children. This event hit the headlines a couple of days later, the 28th of April, and every civilized person in the Western world was aware that yet another horror in the history of 20th century, not to mention 19th century warfare, had occurred. It was this spark that set off Picasso's imagination and his creative energy, and he almost immediately began to make any number of studies, and then finally the finished painting, a large mural in black, white, and gray, which is now, for the time being, on loan to the Museum of Modern Art in New York. That painting, although it seems to be unique for the period, was really one of any number of responses by Spanish artists, not to mention others, to this barbaric omen for the years to come, for the outbreak of the Second World War in 1939. And it should in fact be recalled that Picasso's great Spanish compatriot, Joan Miró, like him in France, more than in Spain, he too made works of art that would contribute to the sense of protest that people throughout the world were experiencing in connection with these terrible days that prefigured the Second World War. For example, Miró made a poster, there you can see it on the right, showing us a Spanish peasant making a gesture of anger and force with his arm, Ede l'Espagne. And for the exposition building in Paris, he made a painting, which has disappeared, The one that you see on the right, again of a Spanish peasant with a scythe in his hand, who seems to be practically scorched with the terror, with the bloodshed, with the burning on the earth of, in this case, Miro's and Picasso's native land. Even before this, after this, in the case of another work by Miro, this is a painting of 1938, we can feel in a less specific context, that is, this is not particularly Spanish propaganda poster or imagery, but even here, you feel the sense of the period of the late 30s, the years of the Spanish Civil War, of something that is monstrous, burned, scorched, and agonized, although within the metaphorical terms of Miro's own language. And it's interesting to see that even an artist who was generally operating, presumably within the realm of some universal subconscious, namely Salvador Dali, even he, at this time, seemed to respond as a human being and as a Spaniard to the tragedy happening again in his native land. In 1936, Señor Dali painted this extraordinarily anguished picture now in the Philadelphia Museum called Soft Construction with Boiled Beans. Those are all there, but the subtitle is Premonitions of Civil War. And the painting represents a sort of dream monster from the id who is hacking away, tearing itself apart, pulling at its own breast on top of a kind of arid Iberian landscape. It is a picture which offers, as it were, a kind of fantastic recreation of the struggle of civil war, of a body, of a people, of a persona fighting against itself. And it seems to me that it is a picture that, as Picasso's Guernica was to do in the following year, refers backwards to any number of traditions, especially Spanish ones. That is, the almost unbearably monstrous painting on the right, you probably, most of you recognize it, is such a work. This is Goya's Saturn, a late painting by that Spanish master, and it represents the mythological subject of Saturn devouring his own children, a famous work in the Prado that seems for Goya to be a kind of metaphor of the disasters of war that he himself had seen under the Napoleonic invasion between 1808 and 14. There again is a kind of metaphorical image of awesome, hideous self-destruction, of bloodshed, a kind of visceral metaphor for the experience of civil war, of a country destroying itself, killing its own people. That is just a suggestion of what might be considered the Iberian, the Spanish response in 1936-7, even among artists who seem to be generally located in an ivory tower, their response to the political facts in their home country. And as artists who tended to live away from Spain, they must have been acutely and suddenly wrenched back into their own consciousness of their Spanish origins. The result of furious weeks of drawings, revisions, and picture making by Picasso, beginning in late April of 1937, to be ready for the opening of the pavilion in June. The result of that painting is the vast mural on the left, which probably many of you have seen. And it might be well, although this painting has become as famous as the Mona Lisa, it might be well quickly just to describe some of the obvious things that are happening within it, as well as some of the things that are a little less visible. One sees on the right-hand side a burning building, which has this terrible sort of indoor-outdoor quality, as if the shelter of human beings had been shattered. And in fact, if one looks at newspaper photographs from 1937 of the first images of the destruction of this Basque city, there is exactly that quality of skeletons of homes, of a kind of confusion of indoors and outdoors that had been caused by the bomb. The building is on fire. You can see flames licking the top, and the woman falls, she herself, on fire in a hideous image that suggests the burst of flame, the destruction of people and buildings that are part of the modern warfare techniques that we have all learned to know about all too well. Above, a woman, one of the most famous images in Picasso's repertory, seems suddenly to be caught in this scream of hysteria, rushing with a speed that is still breathtaking in its velocity. It really catches the visceral sense of alarm and of thrusting one's head out of a window to see something terrible that has happened. She sticks her head out of the window, and she holds, you can see it here, with an elongated arm that expresses the rush of the moment and the instantaneity of the bombing. She holds a lamp with a natural flame within it. Below her, you see a woman seems to be absolutely stunned, like a dazed animal, startled, shocked. Her eyes are glazed, if you can see them. She drags her knee on the ground, and she too seems part of this human baggage that has been assaulted by the destruction, by the death from above. In the center of the painting, and then to the left, one sees a horse whose side is pierced, wounded, as if in some symbolic act that is a metaphor again for the destruction of the city. In front of him, a warrior with his arms outstretched, rather like the image of a crucified Christ that has fallen. He is the male participant or former participant of the group, and he has died, and one sees within him that he is hollow, like a suit of armor rather than like a sentient organic creature. Above, probably a little difficult to see in this slide, you can probably make out, I hope, a bird that is falling from the air onto a table, almost as if it were a kind of symbol of the unnaturalness, of the terror, of the inorganic quality of this destruction from above, almost as if, that is, the very creatures of the air had been destroyed by the lightning flash of death and terror from the sky. And that sky over there is one that seems to be, in a typically Picasso way, a kind of multiple metaphor which I think you can see better here. That is, it seems to suggest, and Picasso by this point, as we discussed it in Girl Before a Mirror, had learned to evoke with one image not one, but two, three, sometimes four things, so that this extraordinary eye that is in almost the center of the painting, that seems to dominate it, seems to be, well, for one thing, just that, an eye, as if it was some malevolent, maybe benevolent deity observing from the heavens above, but it also seems to be a kind of burst of light which might be natural and celestial, but which might also be the force of the destruction from above, as if it were an explosion. And in fact, in the center of it, there is not a pupil, as in an eye, but rather an electric light, which is rather interesting because In fact, when you think about the painting, although it is called Guernica, although it is said to commemorate a particular historical event of the 26th of April, 1937, there is nothing else in the painting that even locates it in the 20th century. We tend to think of it as a picture about the Spanish Civil War, but indeed there is nothing specifically Spanish about it. That is, we don't know what town it is, what country it is. We don't know that it's taking place in 1937, and were it not for the presence of this mechanical thing, a light bulb, we would not even know that it is taking place in the 20th century. So allegorical has Picasso become in transcribing this political, military event into the realm of some kind of universal experience. There, to return to the left-hand portion of the painting, next to this sacrificial bird, which, like the eye of the bomb or the deity, seems even to have almost a kind of a Christian reference, like some kind of holy ghost that has been exploded and killed in the sky. Next to that, there is a bull who seems to be the only living and triumphant creature in the whole painting. His expression is almost humanoid, glazed, disturbed, but nevertheless his tail flares up almost with a sense of victory, and of course in conjunction with the horse wounded on the right, one feels suddenly the introduction of yet another motif of a general archetypal kind, namely the motif of the bullring, which could hardly be more appropriate to a picture about Spain, about the sacrifice of good, about the timeless battle between forces of brutality and forces of benevolence. Beneath the triumphant bull, although it is a complicated sense of triumph, there is one of the most agonized of all of the figures in the painting, the screaming mother whose head turns upward toward the sky, the source of this evil, just as the bird's beak turns upward as it falls, and she is holding in her lap a helplessly dead infant. So, in looking at the picture as a whole, one suddenly begins to realize that the only human survivors are women. There are no men, except for the bull, who is not human, except perhaps in a symbolic way. And one realizes that the picture has been so translated into a kind of timeless, universal language that it cannot be considered a document of any particular event. It could have been painted during the time of the First World War just as easily as during the time of the Spanish Civil War on the eve of the Second World War. The quality of Picasso's art in the 1930s. Oh, that was... is one which, above all, for all of his years, seems to have this curiously synthetic power to incorporate, as it were, the entire history of Western art and Western myth. And in talking just yesterday, was it, about The Girl Before a Mirror, I mentioned certain analogies with Joyce's Finnegan's Wake, another product of this critical decade, the 1930s, in which so many modern masters tried, as it were, to rejoin their art to the traditions that seemed to have been left so far behind. That is, more and more in the 1930s, the great modernists, who were such upstarts at the beginning of the century, were conscious of offering a kind of resumption, a kind of reconnection with the traditions that seemingly had been annihilated by them. As a result, many of these works of the 30s have a kind of conscious historical retrospective quality in which they seem to be translating layer after layer after layer the entire history of Western experience and putting it into one great last will and testament that indeed was really to be destroyed with the Second World War. Very few people, and I am not one of them, have read Finnegan's Wake, but we've all read something about it. And in reading the puns of Joyce and in seeing the level of allusion, one finds that everything from Homer and the Bible to contemporary experience to the styles of all great writers of the past, all of these have been resumed in these dense puns and these multiple references where everything recalls something else. And you have a kind of mirror of history going back to the deepest, most remote archetypes. And that is the kind of thing which I should like to talk about, above all, in Picasso's Guernica. One of the things that the painting recalls in this vast resume of the Western tradition is the very structure of earlier art. It's been commented on, and I think quite correctly, that the structure of Guernica is a curious combination of order and chaos. That is, it's a painting which, even if we cannot read the details of the language, even if we cannot understand, as we probably never will, the symbolism in a one-to-one way, even so, one has a feeling of what is going on. That is, it is a scene of terrible apocalyptic terror. Drama is something that really seems to be exploding, to be bursting, to be screaming and rushing before our eyes. And yet this image of chaos seems somehow to be contained within a formal structure, a configuration that is as old as the Western art itself, that is, as old as the structure of a pedimental frieze. I show you here the sculpture, the reconstructed sculpture of the east and west pediment of a Greek 5th century temple. This is the Temple of Olympia. And it's interesting to see, among other things, that the very theme of this pedimental sculpture, the Battle of the Lapiths and the Centaurs. This is a theme that really deals symbolically in terms of 5th century Greece with the eternal symbolism of a higher and lower instincts in man, rather like the bull and horse symbolism in Picasso's Guernica. But my point here is that, as you can probably see, the rays of light in this painting somehow define a very, very lucid pyramidal structure, which almost seems to be classical, pedimental in quality, and gives a kind of subliminal effect of some sort of original order that has then been shattered by the bombing. In fact, people have commented in the Guernica about the way some of it looks like sculpture that has been smashed, especially in the hollow warrior in the foreground, and that is an illusion that is further borne out by the archetypal imagery of that pedimental form within which these figures are contained. Within that underlying structure, there is also another kind which is inherent in the greatest traditions, the most familiar ones of Western painting, and that is a triptych, because if we think of this as being the central element, the pedimental form here, with the apex at the top, defined by the lamplight, there seem to be two side panels, so that it really has this tripartite form, which is not classical in origin, but really Christian and medieval and Renaissance. I show you here the great Grunewald Isenheim altarpiece, because that is a painting typical of this kind of tripartite structure in Western art, but also because it is a painting which fascinated Picasso at exactly the time that this painting began to germinate. Well, he was interested in the painting from the early 30s on, and it seems really to offer as a kind of Christian prototype of crucifixion imagery any number of clues to the Picasso of 1937. In any case, these two fundamental archetypal structures, a pedimental form and a triptych form, seem to be subsumed in Picasso's painting, so that one almost has the sense that the very core of the Western tradition is threatened in this hysterical assault on the underlying solidity of these forms. But in a more detailed way as well, Guernica is a painting that seems to offer non-stop allusions to almost every period in the history of art, a veritable survey book in one painting, as well as every major theme in the history of such tragic representations as warfare. It has been suggested, for example, and quite convincingly, that representations from the Romanesque period of the apocalypse, especially in a medieval manuscript of Spanish origin, I show you a page from it here, that this was important in the genesis of Guernica. And in fact, this seems a very likely kind of source. Picasso had been aware throughout the 20s and 30s of Romanesque art, especially that which came from Spain, the most powerful and savage variety of Romanesque art. As a Spaniard, he was aware of this. As an art historian artist, he knew that and many other things. And right in time, the Apocalypse of Saint-Sever, that is the manuscript from which you see a page here, was very well known in Paris in the 1930s. It belonged to the Bibliothèque Nationale and was exhibited there and frequently reproduced. The sense of some sort of biblical destruction, the imagery of the apocalypse, of the visions of Saint John, these could be seen in medieval form, and has been suggested in even particular terms. Something like this crude and hollow warrior in the foreground seems to have his 1930s resurrection in the features and structure of the figure in the Picasso. Other great themes and images from the history of art seem again to have been digested by this artist who probably more than any 20th century artist, or indeed any artist before him, managed somehow to grind up everything he saw and translate it into his own language. The whole Louvre, the whole repertory of world art, seems to be in his work, and especially in his major paintings. Thus, the painting seems to refer to some of the most time-honored and frequently illustrated themes that deal with a similar moment of tragedy in both the Bible and in classical legend. The Rape of the Sabines, I show you the interpretation by Poussin on the right. The Rape of the Sabines is the classical counterpart to the kind of imagery Picasso chose for the theme of Guernica, namely a picture that really deals primarily with the suffering of women and children. The men are bestial. It is the women and children who are left to survive, to suffer, and that is one of the motifs that seems to be digested and recreated by Picasso. Another, the biblical counterpart to the legend of the Rape of the Sabines, is the massacre of the innocents And I show you here a 17th century painting of this subject by Guido Reni, which once more concentrates on the horror of battle and warfare in terms of showing it not as something heroic, but in terms of the suffering it wreaks upon innocent women and children. Indeed, the particular expressions of some of these women, the sense of velocity, these have even been suggested, it may or may not be true, as sources for Picasso. Indeed, one of the problems in discussing this painting in terms of particular sources is that you can almost suggest anything that is relevant to this frame of grand tragic reference. Picasso somehow seems to have pointed his eye there and there and there, so that we can almost discern allusions, but they are never one-to-one allusions, to all of these themes and images from the Western past. Thus, one can even think of another great biblical theme in conjunction with the Guernica, namely the conversion of St. Paul, originally Saul, who saw the light of the divinity on the road to Damascus, and you see him here in a painting by Caravaggio. The particular conjunction of horse and rider, the sense of outstretched arms reaching upward toward a dark sky, these are things that have a general, if not a specific, shock of recognition in the context of the foreground figure, almost religious in its outstretched arms, in a sense of revelation, but its eyes are glazed and unseeing, vis-a-vis the horse, and looking up at this divine, or is it malevolent light from above. And it has even been suggested informally that, well, maybe this has to do with Picasso's own conversion, insofar as the name Paul, needless to say, is the equivalent of Pablo, but that may push things too far. Whatever, it is telling that when we see such an image of the conversion of Saul Paul, looking up at some kind of revelation, we feel that it too has been subsumed in some of these quasi-Christian symbols in Picasso's painting. On yet another level, the allegorical one, the painting seems to suggest a whole other tradition of the rendering of the horror of war, not through literal accounts of the suffering of men, women, children, horses, and the like, but through a kind of allegorical interpretation in which the figures seem to be almost symbolic, representing disaster, bologna, victory, truth, and the like. The Rubens over here on the right is one such work. This is an allegory of war, and indeed in some ways Rubens is more like Picasso than Caravaggio is, because he is a master at mixing in the same work images that seem to have a kind of palpable reality, like the fleeing figures on the right, or the hysterical woman with arms upstretched here, almost the analog of the one falling from the window over there. Mixing such a figures from the real world with allegorical ones, so that the level is instantly transcended, the level of fact, into one of fiction and symbolism. And in yet another domain of the history of art, there seems to be, and this I would suggest is even more precise and conscious than some of the more generalized ones I've been showing you, there seems to be in the strange, numb and stunned, almost animalized figure of the woman in the lower right foreground, there seems to be a reference to the astonishing figure in Aang's Jupiter and Thetis of the supplicating nymph Thetis, who is beseeching Jupiter for aid in the Trojan wars below to help her son Achilles. The strange quality of the figure with that extraordinarily extended neckline and the Greek profile, the looking upwards to the heavens to some sort of supreme deity for succor, that is the image in classical art or neoclassical art that Picasso somehow has parodied in terms of this woman who looks up to the sky but not with a conscious and seductive request for help, but rather as some sort of desperate, bewildered citizen of a bombed town. That is a kind of inversion in Picasso's art of a source in Aang, an artist who he is constantly quoting from the very beginning to the end of his long career. In more modern terms, to understand Picasso's painting, one needs as well to look back to a specifically 19th and 20th century tradition of rendering the horrors of war, which began to seem so monstrous and so conspicuous to artists beginning with Goya and continuing down to the time of Picasso, Miro, and Dali in the late 30s. One must never forget Picasso's immense knowledge of and absorption of his great compatriot and forerunner in the rendering of the disasters of war, Francisco Goya. And Goya's Disasters of War, a series of prints inspired by his need to record the hideous documentary facts of Spain between 1808 and 1814. These are images that seem to have all kinds of general and specific echoes in Picasso's work. I show you one of these Goya prints, some of them almost as unbearable to look at as the agony of the individual figures in the Picasso. And it's worth mentioning that they too, although they seem to have the quality almost of a kind of journalist's photograph on the spot, have a kind of nowhere look. They are taking place really not so much at a particular site, but they have about them a kind of neutral, dark light ground that is very like the universal dimension suggested in Picasso's work. I'd like to add another point about these Goya prints in connection with one of the questions that has often been asked about Guernica, which is why is the painting not in color? The painting is, as I mentioned before, in black and white and shades of gray with a slightly bluish quality at times, but the general look of the painting is one of grisaille. And like everything else in the painting, this fact, this absence of color, has been the subject of debate and the subject of multiple interpretations. I think generally, when one is confronted with different interpretations of anything about Guernica, the answer is that not one is correct, but probably any of them that makes sense is correct. Because that is the nature of the beast, a quality to synthesize all kinds of meanings within one image, within one idea, or in this case, within one tonality. One of the reasons for the painting being in black, white, and gray may be the common reference, the common emotional reference of these colors or non-colors, namely that these are the colors of mourning. One associates these colors with the death of somebody, and in this case with the death of a town, because so it seemed at the time. This meant the destruction, the annihilation of a city. So in that context alone, the color would be appropriate. But there is yet another level in which this choice of non-color seems to ring true, for it has about it the reference to the means of the communication of factual documentary information about warfare. Symbolic contrast, a kind of polarity between the light of good and the blackness of evil. Brought to 20th century date, that kind of black and white image seems to speak for the image communication power of the photograph. For one has to remember that the visual evidence of the bombing of Guernica in 1937 was communicated through the photograph, through the daily newspaper, and Picasso, like everybody else, saw these images, so that there, too, an allusion to the peculiar 20th century quality of black and white news photos seems to be conveyed by this peculiar rejection of the traditional colors of painting. Even more, important, I think, for a comprehension of Guernica is Goya's own summation of the disasters of war series, namely the great painting that he executed after the fact in 1814 to commemorate for the newly restored King of Spain the terrible execution of Spanish civilians, guerrillas, during the days of the Napoleonic invasion on the 3rd of May, 1808. And there you see this painting. One notes that even though this painting is in color, it too almost moves to the extremes of black and white, especially since it takes place under a benighted sky, and especially since the white of the painting tends to be so intense that it points up, as it does in Guernica, the quality of the instantaneity, the kind of immediacy and terror of death. No one who looks at the upraised arms of the central victim in this group of people being executed will forget the quality of this white, which almost has a symbolic character, especially in contradistinction to the black of the sky or the black shadows of the Napoleonic firing squad. But even more, and this in conjunction with Guernica, the source of death, the source of this devastation, seems to be this funny lantern that has been put down on the ground by the French firing squad. And as you can see, everything that comes within the rays of this beam of light is being annihilated or has just been annihilated. Indeed, there seems to me to be a strong parallel between this sort of mechanical light, almost as if it had usurped a natural, godly light, and the light of this terrible bulb above, which seems again to wreak havoc on the town. That seems to be the source of the destruction, the beams being analogous to the flames on the house and the woman, the sense of something menacing and evil in the pupil that has become an electric bulb, almost as if it were a bomb, whose shape it actually resembles. One notices, too, in Goya's painting that he already, in 1814, managed to elevate his painting from a particular fact to something universal. We hardly know where this is taking place. It seems to belong now already to a universal domain. And the imagery of the central victim here with his upraised arms and the man who has preceded him, fallen like this figure, but on his stomach rather than his back. These are images that recall the crucifixion, like some sort of martyr from the Christian tradition who has been horribly translated into a secular victim of a kind that was repeated ad infinitum in the 19th and 20th centuries. On yet another level of interpretation, this painting of contemporary bloodshed, Delacroix's Liberty Leading the People, his own imaginative recreation of the events of the July Revolution of 1830, this painting seems again to offer some premonition of the problems that would beset Picasso in painting this picture. Namely, it begins with a literal fact, the events of July 28th to 30th in Paris in 1830, and it includes, in this case, such literal things as a view of the quays of Paris and Notre Dame and the French flag. But within the pile of massacred bodies in the foreground, like the warrior and Picasso, there emerges again a symbolic figure, a figure of one feels triumph, victory, truth, La France, who is the Gallic equivalent of some sort of spirit, some sort of allegory, rather like the figure who holds the lamp, which now seems not to be just a plain lamp, but a symbol of truth rising from the earth to confront the heaven-sent bomb in the center of the painting. Other images, in fact, from the early 19th century that deal with this imaginative recreation of contemporary war may well have been added as grist to this enormous mill of Picasso. And one of the most unusual is this bronze relief of 1834 by a sculptor contemporary of Delacroix, namely his name is Préau. This is again inspired by the massacres of the July Revolution of 1830, and once again, even more than Delacroix, it transcends a literal political and military fact and just becomes a kind of allegory of a human terror, with especially the stretched, hysterical, swift movement of a woman's head in the foreground, who seems almost to be the romantic prototype of the unforgettable image of movement and screaming that we have in the central figure in the Picasso. I mentioned before that excuse me. Even within the context of Picasso's own work, the great themes suggested by Guernica, but only in an elusive, not a direct way, the great themes can be found. It is inevitable in looking at the juxtaposition of a bull and a horse, especially in the work of a Spanish painter about Spain, it is inevitable to think of the time-old drama of the bull ring. And one should recall here that throughout Picasso's career, both before and after Guernica, he had illustrated with various degrees of symbolic intensity the drama of the bull versus the horse. In the years just preceding Guernica, the confrontation of these two creatures, which so quickly take on symbolic dimensions, became particularly brutal and intense. And I'm showing you here a detail. You can hardly see any of the spectators of the ring itself. But here is a detail of a 1934 bullfight by Picasso in which the drama of bull versus horse really takes on almost a moral charade. That is, one feels that the bull is a symbol of incredible ferocity, a sub-noble creature, as opposed to the white horse, whose head twisted around at that angle is one that prefigures Guernica, and one that is very common in Picasso's treatment of a wounded horse. Even the coloring or non-coloring of these two animals in the polarization between black and white begins to suggest something beyond the obvious observation of just an aficionado. There is something here that again moves into the domain of a moral drama, especially with these strange spectators, like a chorus of Greeks in a drama, who seem to watch as if something far more important than a bullfight itself was taking place. Picasso, in fact, in just these years before the execution of the Guernica, made any number of symbolic statements, very, very elusive, very difficult to pinpoint in any one-to-one reading, made a kind of translation of that strange and evocative mix of man and bull provided by the legend of the Minotaur. He invented all kinds of narrative situations for the Minotaur, which seemed to be a creature that struggled between two kinds of experience, bestial and human and noble, and it is that kind of interplay between the human and the animal, especially vis-a-vis the horse, who turns up as well from the bullfight, within this Minotaur symbolism. This all becomes suddenly a kind of evasive interpretation of struggles within individual men, which was finally to become a struggle in a public domain, that of the early history of the Second World War. I mentioned that this painting seems just to breathe the ghosts, to resurrect the spirits of any number of great themes from the Western world, and I would think that the most potent of them all is in the unforgettably tragic figure of the woman on the left with the dead child, who seems to be looking up at the dumb, glazed bull, who seems to be, in turn, a kind of agent of this destruction, but a sort of a stupid, unrealizing one, like the armies that fight for governments they know little about. Here we have, especially in a context which seems to allude more and more to Christian symbolism, here we have a modern 1937 recreation of the traditional image of the Pietà. And I show it to you side by side with the most famous representation of the theme, that by Michelangelo, except for the poignant fact that in 1937, for Picasso and for so many people, the whole drama of the martyrdom of Christ and the redemption of man seemed to have been blighted, annihilated, made a joke of by the actual political and military facts of the world in which he lived in the late 30s. Indeed, as I mentioned before, the theme of the crucifixion and the adjacent Christian narratives was something that had fascinated Picasso throughout the 30s, and in that very year, 1930, he painted a small and difficult crucifixion, but before, during, and after, he made any number of studies of the theme of the crucifixion, including prominently in most of them the figure of a horse who seems therefore so easily translatable to the horse in the Guernica. Reception of the Guernica in 1937 is a complicated subject, as is its assessment in terms of the history of 20th century art, and I really don't want to go into that and would prefer to let you think about that or judge it for yourselves. But I would like to add some more historical facts to your thinking about this, and one of them is for you to look at a painting that Picasso executed not before, but at the end of the Second World War. And that is the terrible work that you see on the right, awe-inspiring. That is a scene that Picasso left unfinished of bodies trussed and bound like something in a still life. That were inspired, in fact, by actual seeing of concentration camp photos in Paris in the mid-40s. Picasso seems to have turned away from the public issues of Guernica after 1937, though we feel the gloom of the Second World War in his art in the early 40s. But in 1947, upon seeing these documentary facts, these photographs, like the photographs of Guernica, he turned to a kind of terrible postlude to the events you see here. A grim still life, if it can be called that, of human bodies who are just thrown into a room like so much garbage. Again, the image. Oops. Seems to be inspired in a general way by the horrifyingly frank records of the facts of war in the work of Goya and his Disasters of War. And here is a grim etching by Goya of human beings, women again in this case, thrown into a pit along with furniture, making no distinction between the organic and the inorganic, except in an ironic commentary, all of this offering a kind of prefiguration in the early 19th century in Spain of what Picasso was to do in his response to the facts of the Nazi concentration camps. The picture was left unfinished. Somehow it seems for Picasso to have been too painful, too difficult to complete, and as such, it almost seems to offer a terrible and heart-rending statement of how, after 1944 and 5, it almost became impossible for any artist to deal with paint and canvas with the realities of warfare in the period after the atom bomb. In fact, Picasso tried on several occasions to show us what was happening in the post-Hiroshima world. In 1951, for example, he painted, I show it to you in black and white, but it's in color, an allegorical interpretation of the massacres that took place in the Korean War. And here, as opposed to Guernica, he uses the Goya executions as a quite literal prototype. But it's perfectly apparent to all spectators that this painting, though it deals with a terrible human event, seems to be limp, almost trivial by comparison with the power and the passion of Guernica. And even on an allegorical level, as in this painting of 1952, which follows the Korean massacres, this is supposed to be by Picasso an allegory of war. This too is a painting that by no means has the conviction, the concentration, the drama and energy of the Guernica, it seems once again to be a kind of a diffuse, almost a comic strip picture that makes us realize how impossible it had become for Picasso, and I suspect for almost all artists, to deal with these facts in the world after 1945. In the 1960s, a few American pop artists tried perhaps to come to some kind of grips with a panoramic view of the horror of the facts of political life and military life in this continent. I am talking about, well, you see one half of it. Rosenquist's F-111 mural, his attempt to come to some kind of terms with America during the time of the Vietnam War. And it is a picture that, again, seems to provide a kind of collage or photographic allegory of the terrible mixture of bombs, F-111, and smiling glossy children under hair dryers. But this painting, again, seems never to come close to the grim facts of Guernica. And one may well wonder whether any artist could come to terms with war and death after the Second World War. The period really seemed to demand a new kind of interpretation of the facts of life and death in the modern world, probably the most intensely to the point being that by Andy Warhol in 1962, who simply replicated the kind of front page that we all look at and turn, telling us about another aerial catastrophe, the death of 129 people in a jet plane. That seems to be a statement of the changes in the 20th century before and after the Second World War. Thank you very much.
Ladies and gentlemen, Professor Rosenblum has indicated that he would be pleased to answer questions from the audience.
Yes.
Computer,
I don't know, that seems to be a... That seems to be a very hot question these days at both the Museum of Modern Art and I guess in Spain. I don't think, I may be incorrect, but I don't think anything has been decided about it, including where in Spain it would go if it were returned. My own feeling is that it should be, but I don't know. Yeah.
Suppose Picasso would have listened to your opposing interpretation of Guernica tonight. Would you expect him to have nodded in full agreement throughout, or is it conceivable that he would have been taken by surprise because he neither consciously nor subconsciously really drew on all these parallels?
This gentleman asked a question which I'm sure many of you asked yourselves during my presentation, and which is the kind of question that is often posed, especially to freewheeling art historians, namely, would Picasso have recognized the truth of any or all of what I said? I think, well, in personal terms, Picasso probably would have shrugged his shoulders because that was the way he usually responded when people asked him to interpret his works. He was unbelievably close-mouthed about what anything meant, especially Guernica. He said practically nothing about it, and people were begging for one-to-one decodings. What does the bull mean? Is it a symbol of Spain? Is it a symbol of good? Is it a symbol of evil? What does the horse mean? And so on. He wouldn't have been very helpful, and he probably wouldn't have been too nasty. He probably just would have been indifferent. But This said, I would want to defend the presentation, which may seem, just excessively speculative, insofar as if there was ever any artist in the history of art who looked at everything, who was acutely conscious of being the carrier of a great tradition and who was in constant rivalry with every old master who ever lived. He, Picasso, did conscious reinterpretations of works by Poussin, Grunewald, Ang, Manet, Velasquez, etc., etc. He is the all-time art historian. But I don't think that the process, and this is a difficult question about, you know, the creative psychology of an artist, I don't think that the process of digesting these things and referring to them was a conscious program. I think it's unconscious. That is, he's one of those geniuses like a great punster, a la James Joyce, who just somehow has the knack of making a multiple image, and lo and behold, eureka, everything comes out right. It means three, four things simultaneously, and the genius in question, Joyce or Picasso, may not even have known that he did it. It just, that is why he is great and different from other lesser artists. But, and that is also because the allusions are so multiple and so digested, that is also why it's very, very tricky to say that this is the particular source, because it never seems to have a single correlation. Everything seems to exist in layers. They're just sort of ghost levels of reference. So I don't think you could really ever prove or disprove any of this. It's just a question of the degree to which it contributes in a sensible or commonsensical way. Yes?
Would you mind commenting on the symbolism of the sex of the figures? I'm sure it must have gone through your mind as you were examining the detail. There seemed to be something in the sex that...
You mean their sex organs or their gender?
You commented, for instance, that the one with the arms outstretched was female.
Yeah.
And the one lying on the bed was female.
Well, they're all female, with the exception of the warrior in the foreground with his arms outstretched. He's male. He's a warrior. But all of these survivors, all of the living people in the painting are female.
Is there any reason for coming to that conclusion?
Oh, yes. There's just no... it isn't even a question of speculation. They're absolutely intelligible as female. And this is simply a question of being familiar with Picasso's language. That is, one couldn't look at this painting without having seen many other paintings by Picasso and expect to read the anatomical details or anything else easily. But the more you see of related paintings, the more obvious it is what his frame of reference is. So there really isn't any question about that. There are a lot of ambiguous things, but that's not one of them. Yeah.
You didn't refer to any of the numerous studies that Picasso or Guernica. I wonder if any of them give any strong confirmation to any of your theories of whether any of the illusions that you see in Guernica are apparent in these studies.
I don't think so. I don't think that would really help. I mean, oh, I'm sorry. I was just asked, yes, the audience is still, I was just asked whether the studies for Guernica, of which there are many, and the evolution of the painting, of which there are photographic records, whether these would contribute in any way to pinpointing some of the broader historical references I offered. And I think not in any specific way. In fact, if anything, it would probably complicate it even more by adding yet another series of potential images, because these are, the final result tends to be distilled and selected. So I think it would spread the net, if anything, even wider. Yeah.
I'm wondering, is why would a man in a defenseless town be holding a weapon? Is that a problem in the interpretation?
Oh, No, because it's not a literal rendering. I mean, nobody knows, as I hope to suggest, I mean, this is not a city, this is not a picture of Guernica in any literal sense, or even of modern warfare, so that he is just a warrior, if he is, who has not been involved in battle. I mean, it's an archaic form of battle anyway, if he's a warrior in what seems to be a sort of metal armored or shielded costume with a sword. So he's a completely non-modern warrior anyway, which contributes to the sort of universal dimensions of the picture, but it makes no sense in terms of modern, in terms of the actual event. Yeah.
Do you think that the Pietà could also be seen as a nativity scene with the Virgin holding the dead Christ, symbolizing the destruction of Christian ideals, in the dead baby Christ rather than the adult?
Yeah, I think, you know, because Picasso has had to invent his own symbolism. It's a private symbolism that is based on earlier traditional public symbolism. That's one of the reasons that it's so easy to speculate on it, because everything is an evocation and a translation of an archetypal image, so that you could think of it as the destruction of a Madonna and child, as of a nativity scene, as well as a recreation of a Pietà with the adult Christ. I mean, it would work either way. And there's also, which I didn't point out, I recall, there's a flower growing in the central foreground of the painting, very faint, which seems to be, again, something very elusive. It suggests some kind of rebirth, resurrection, a hope for the future. But one couldn't say anything more than that. It suggests the idea of spring, of a possibility of redemption, but it's very faint. And if you ask Picasso, what does that flower mean, he wouldn't say, and he could never pinpoint it, because that would destroy the magic to say this is that. If you could decode everything in the painting, it would be a very bad painting. It would be one-dimensional.
Is it true that the painting is done in a tempera?
It's what? I don't know. I don't think so, but does somebody know for a fact? I don't think.
Soil.
Excuse me? Soil, yeah. I never heard it was egg tempera, but...
Can you tell us something about the process of the painting? That is, how long the studies took and the painting itself?
How long? Oh, it was weeks. I've forgotten. I should really not have. Maybe somebody here knows the exact days, but it's really a matter of weeks, past a month, but something like 6 weeks or so. I've forgotten the exact number. Yeah.
What truth is there to the some of the stories we hear about what the Germans thought about this painting? Is there any truth to the fact that they supposedly, or is this one of these myths that's been handed down, that when they asked him what had he done, he said, it's not what I have done.
Yeah, you did it. Yeah.
Is there any truth to that?
I don't know. I mean, that's a recorded legend, and since it's within the lifetime of the people who record it, I suspect it is true. But I don't know whether it's true verbatim.
If there are no further questions, I'd like to make two announcements. First, the draft program for the spring series of lectures is available this evening. Some of you will have received copies. There will be additional copies available on the way out. The first of the spring series will be on January the 7th and will be given by Sir Alfred Ayer, and the title is What Has Become of Philosophy? Second announcement, there will be coffee outside this evening for those of you who wish to stay for a little while, and Professor Rosenblum will be available to chat with interested members. And thirdly, I would like to call upon Professor Knox, head of the Department of Fine Arts, to thank Professor Rosenblum on our behalf.
For four marvelous lectures about a very, very great painter.